Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Tina Quinn and it's a pleasure as always to have your company. This week on Fourth Estate, we look at what's been a very big week for social media news. Billionaire and so-called free speech warrior Elon Musk has gotten himself into a war of words with the Australian government. He's defying orders from Australia's eSafety Commissioner to remove a video of the Wakeley stabbing from his social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter. And it's raised the ire of politicians from across the aisle.
We'll do what's necessary to take on this arrogant billionaire who thinks he's above the law, but also above common decency. And the idea that someone would go to court for the right to put up violent content on a platform shows how out of touch Mr. Musk is.
I think he's a social media knob with no social conscience. He has absolutely no social conscience. Someone like that should be in jail and the key be thrown away.
It just beggars belief, yeah. Really, doesn't it? That this guy, this egotistical billionaire, thinks that it's more important for him to be able to show whatever he wants on X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it today. It's more important for him to have his way than to respect the victims of the crimes that are being shown on social media.
You know, I think he's a bit of a narcissistic cowboy, frankly, and he gets off on this stuff.
It's all part of a bigger discussion around censorship. What should be shared online? Who should decide? And is it really possible to stop the spread of violent imagery on the internet? To discuss, I'm joined by reporter for the Sun Herald and friend of Fourth Estate, Amber Schultz. Welcome back, Amber.
Hi, Tina.
And political reporter for Guardian Australia in Canberra, Josh Butler. Thanks for being with us, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So to give a bit of background, I might go to you first. What is the eSafety Commissioner asking for exactly here?
Yeah, so the eSafety Commissioner has ordered a number of social media networks to remove videos of the Wakeley church stabbing, which obviously, that awful attack there that, very infamously was, live broadcast, the church service on the internet. Most of the social media networks complied, at least said that they complied with that order. And obviously Twitter or X said that it had complied with what they, the part of the order that they wanted to comply with and said that they weren't able to or declined to meet all of the parts of the order. And that's what this federal court case popped up a few times in the last week goes to, about whether X has fulfilled the requirements, the requests of the order of the eSafety Commission.
Does the government actually have grounds for the takedown actions they're seeking?
Well, they do. The eSafety Commissioner has quite a broad range of powers. The eSafety Commission, I think, is quite an interesting sort of body. There are other governments around the world that have sort of similar, online safety, commissioners or bureaucrats or so forth. But the eSafety Commissioner in Australia sort of, they like to talk about how they're doing sort of world-leading or industry-leading work in, keeping people safe, what they say is, keeping people safe online. So it does have quite a broad range of powers to do this. I mean, obviously X is disputing it's sort of niche, but it's not really niche. They're disputing this part of the order or part of the eSafety Commissioner's request that it should block the content for not just every Australian who has their online network set to being in Australia. It's saying that it should also block the ability of people who are in Australia but use a VPN or a virtual private network which, you know, without going too deep in the details, basically it means you can sort of portray yourself as being overseas in, you know, Sweden or in America or in, you know, whatever. Most people use those sort of things for very, you know, innocent purposes. Maybe it's, you know, you want to watch the American version of Netflix or something like that. But the eSafety Commission is saying, well, we've asked you to block it for every Australian. That means every single person in Australia. And X's response is, well, you know, and I, you know, I'll be really interested in the outcome of this particular argument. X is saying, well, that would essentially make us have to block it for every single person on the whole planet. And the eSafety Commission, or, you know, any government agency anywhere in the world shouldn't be able to make laws for the rest of the whole world, basically. So it is quite an interesting particular situation that we've got here.
So the eSafety Commissioner says their concern here is that people in Australia can most likely get around that geo-block with a VPN. Or do you think they're also worried about people outside of Australia seeing the footage?
I think there has been, I guess, a determination made that, you know, the average person shouldn't maybe be able to see that footage. I thought it was quite interesting yesterday that the Bishop Marmari actually came out and said that he didn't agree. You know, the person who was the victim of that stabbing attack, you know, said that he didn't necessarily agree that all the videos should be taken down. The eSafety Commission's order is about Australia. I mean, it's about the jurisdiction of Australia. I'm not sure if I've seen comments from them sort of talking more broadly about whether the video itself should just be, you know, globally blocked. I think that's a different sort of argument. But essentially, this dispute is about what people in Australia are seeing or not seeing.
Amber, do we know what grounds an Australian agency has to restrict content that's outside of Australia? Is there international, you know, Josh was sort of just touching on that, but is there international law which governs what countries can force companies to do outside of their borders?
Not as far as I know, and this is why it's a really sort of contentious issue. I think X has come out and said, look, we geo-blocked it, that's fair enough, but to come out and have this done on a global scale, I think raises certain questions. So there are regulations around, you know, like child sex abuse material, things like that. You can have sort of global blockers on and global regulations, but things like violence, I think it would be the first time that Australian government has tried to do this on a global scale. You know, and I think it's really interesting because it does raise questions about what countries should be able to block material in other countries from being seen. And that's exactly X's argument, is that Australia doesn't have jurisdiction over its global users.
Mm. So Elon Musk is basically trying to tell us all that Australia's eSafety Commissioner isn't the boss of him, right? But the legal standpoint that X are trying to put forward is a bit more substantial. Their point is about free speech and the impingement of free speech. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly it. So I think X has obviously taken a bit more of a nuanced stance in saying that this is free speech. This is about, you know, censorship and trying to govern an entire world and what, and you know, all of X's users can see. Elon Musk has come out and said a few certain other words. You know, he's called the eSafety Commissioner, Julie Iman Grant, a communist authority and the Australian Censorship Commissioner. So he's really playing on this idea that this isn't censorship. This isn't just regulation or jurisdiction. This is affecting free speech.
Right. So apparently Julie Inman Grant's a communist. Okay. So Josh Butler.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I mean, are we ever going to sort of graduate from these sort of commies versus capitalists sort of narrative that we've gotten in popular culture?
That's a good question. Like Amber said, like, you know, touching on that sort of communist thing, like it was just, you know, obviously Julian McGrand is not a communist, but it, yeah, I think the term you used was like censorship commissar or something like that, which is like you know, communist party sort of term. You know, a lot of this stuff has been sort of quite childish. I think, like, you know, obviously this is, if people, you know, follow Elon Musk online or are aware of the sort of stuff that he, you know, generally sort of does, I mean, I think his responses here have been pretty on brand for the kind of stuff that he does, the kind of brand that he has. He's posting all these like memes about it and, you know, like real boomer sort of memes. he called, you know, Jackie Lambie, the Tasmanian senator, spent a couple of days this week, you know, really laying into Elon Musk. I think she said, you know, he should be in jail and, you know, he's, you know, called him a few choice sort of insults. And then he, you know, she deleted her ex account. And then yesterday, day before, Elon Musk, you know, says that she's a danger to Australian society or a traitor or something like that. A real sort of weird back and forth there between, you know, Jackie Lambie and, you know, the world's richest man, I thought was quite an interesting development in this saga.
Did we ever think that we'd be waking up to Elon Musk and Jackie Lambie having a bit of an argument or a stoush? Or those are two names I never thought I'd see in the same, you know, sentence.
I think what's gotten really interesting as well is just how personal the attacks are. I mean, we expected it from Elon Musk, but something that's, you know, in front of court, to have sort of Anthony Albanese and Chris Minns and just so many people pile on Musk. You know, Albanese says that, like, Musk chose ego and is showing violence over common sense, whereas Minns has called him a narcissistic billionaire. Like, it's really gotten into childish personal attack territory, which is quite interesting to see from an entire government, sort of all walks of life, the politicians piling on Musk and of course, him responding.
If I could pick up on that, I mean, I'm not sure if we might discuss this a bit more in detail a bit later on, but that is exactly one of the things that I've found most sort of striking about this last week, sort of covering the politics of it from Canberra.
Is the bipartisanship of it, or?
Well, no. Well, sort of. I was just sort of interested by, there seemed to be this contest every day of who could have the spiciest kind of quote about Elon Musk. It wasn't, yeah, and I realised that, you know, this whole issue kind of, you know, the roots of it go back to these awful stabbings that were in Sydney in the last couple of weeks, and, you know, so horrific, and all these victims. And I think that's something that's been lost a little bit in the last few days of conversation. But there are a lot of, you know, really multi-layered issues at heart here. I mean, there's, you know, talk about, you know, mental health and violence against women and, you know, access to weapons and, you know, watch lists and, you know, what the authorities are doing about terrorism and, you know, encrypted messages and all these sort of things. But, you know, these are all really big, thorny, tricky issues that don't have an immediate solution, or at least one that we've heard yet. And I sort of found it quite striking that, like, as soon as this came along, Elon Musk, you know, big billionaire, he's, you know, not very popular in certain circles. Every single politician, like, jumped on it and attacked him. And I don't mean this in a way of, you know, standing up for Elon Musk. I think, you know, it comes to the territory. Like, I think he enjoys, you know, being the villain in the story or whatever. But I did find it really interesting that, like, the one thing that all these politicians could agree on, like, you know, the bipartisanship, like you said, Tina, was, you know, they all hate Elon Musk and everyone wanted to give the juiciest quote about him.
Because we've even got the coalition jumping in here. I mean, they're usually the, you know, the purveyors of protecting free speech, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe not as strong sort of personal insult terms, but, you know, there has been, you know, a lot of concern raised about, you know, the coalition have dusted off this idea that they've had for a while about age verification and age assurance on social media. You know, that they've raised that issue around... underage people having access to online pornography and that sort of thing. But now they've sort of broadened it to say, well, you know, there should be more blockers on the age of people to get a social media account and that sort of thing. So there has been, you know, I think there is a bipartisan push for some kind of big, you know, crackdown on the big, scary, big tech companies. And I think that is on the way.
Amber, just also a bit of background to Julianne Mangrant. Now, she's American and she used to work for X and Twitter as well.
She has as well. So she's quite, you know, well-versed in these sorts of things. And since taking the role, she's also been quite forward in a lot of the things that she said and quite not heavy-handed, but willing to use the tools at her disposal in order to sort of crack down on some of these social media giants. And I think it's come, you know, her posting and some of her actions have come at a really interesting time, not only, you know, because of Elon Musk's takeover of X, but also because of the news media bargaining code and the misinformation and disinformation voluntary regulation. There's been so many movements to try and regulate these media giants in the last couple of years. And Julianne Mangrant is really fighting an uphill battle to get X to comply or to get these sort of regulations in motion.
Because she's a former senior official at Twitter, do you think she's able to see, she knows how to inflict the most pain on the company when it fails to meet what she would deem community standards. She knows its, you know, soft underbelly or where its weaknesses are.
I mean, yes and no. So she's fighting X with this stabbing post, or 65 specific stabbing posts, with a fine of $785,000 a day. You know, she would know the Achilles heel of X. I think she would know where to look and what to point at. But it just, you know, as this case shows, it's not working particularly effectively. I think when a regulator comes up against such a big personality who is using his sort of defiance against governance and using these sort of very, you know, large topics like free speech and very inflammatory topics like free speech, I think it shows that, you know, she could have all the powers in the world, but she's still really, really struggling to deal with these, you know, giant faces, these giant industries.
So you actually think she's fighting a losing battle then?
Look, honestly, I think this shows, you know, there's a court order and Twitter still isn't complying. They did comply, you know, with the geo blockers, and we have had Meta and Google comply. But I think just the fact that Elon Musk can come out and just and flat out refuse to a court order speaks volumes. You know, I don't think that she has the power in this relationship at all.
Josh?
It is a really interesting question. I'm not sure if it's a losing battle. I think all the points that Amber just raised then are all really good points to say, you know, these big tech companies don't like to, not to say that they don't like to listen to governments, but I think they don't like to be told what to do with their own property and their own platforms. A lot of these tech companies started out with, you know, quite a commitment or, you know, philosophical adherence to, you know, free speech and marketplace of ideas and let's all debate this and blah, blah, you know, don't impinge my free speech, which I think is really, really important. It is a tricky one where it does come up against exactly this kind of issue of, you know, I think we're all for free speech and all this sort of thing until it does harm or until it, you know, can be shown to maybe cause harm or you know, elicit further harm or something like that. I'm not sure if it's a losing battle, but I think at this point it is tricky. I think, you know, I'm not really sure what they can do to X if they don't comply. I mean, they can fine X, but I think very famously they don't really have a lot of staff here in Australia, or maybe any staff. Obviously, they collect some level of revenue through advertising and so forth. I wouldn't be surprised, you know, this is just me spitballing, I have no specific knowledge of this, but I wouldn't be surprised if there is some sort of movement towards, you know, trying to tax some of these companies at a greater level on, you know, maybe they don't have operations here or an office or that sort of thing, but, you know, they do collect advertising money from Australian sources, Australian companies, you know, the Australian government still advertises on a lot of these platforms, including Twitter, I think. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there is some move towards trying to tax these companies differently or more. But this is also a growing kind of movement, not just here, but around the world. You know, little old Australia is, you know, very small fish in the big pond when we think about, you know, all the governments around the world that Twitter and Facebook and TikTok and whoever have to deal with. So I'm not really sure that, you know, one country going out on its own like the Lone Ranger is going to change like the free speech policies of Twitter. But if Australia does it and then America does it and the UK does it and all these other countries around the world do it, which they are doing, you know, for instance, Canada is, you know, tried to do their own version of the news bargaining code last year, and Facebook just like shut off all the news in Canada like they did with Australia in 2021, I think, when we tried doing the news bargaining code the first time around. You know, there is a push in other countries to sort of rein in the power of the big tech giants, and, you know, one country on its own can't really do a lot, maybe, but if there is this sort of concerted global push, which there is in a lot of areas, you sort of have to think that, you know, the tide eventually does start to turn.
I think that's why we're seeing so many companies dig their heels in and just say that they won't. The, you know, the news media bargaining code, I think, sort of made the dominoes fall for a lot of countries around the world to start advocating for similar things. And that's why I think Elon Musk and Twitter are fighting this order so hard, because they don't want to set a precedent that other countries could do the same thing.
You're listening to Fourth Estate on the Community Radio Network. My guests are Amber Schultz and Josh Butler. So, look, it does actually raise a bit of an interesting question here. I mean, would we be happy if X obeyed the request of another country? So, you know, say Russia or China or the United States, if they were saying to them or requesting that they take down content about something in those countries, would we be pleased?
I think that is the argument that they're sort of making, and I do have sympathy for that argument. I've seen people make the argument that, you know, what if it was, you know, footage of the Tiananmen Square, you know, tank incident or something like that, you know, what if it was footage of, you know, insert massacre here? I think that is a fair point to say, but the flip side of that argument is this isn't, this particular incident with the church stabbing, this isn't, you know, just like an embarrassing video for the government. It's not like, you know, some embarrassing video of the prime minister and the government wants to take it down like for political purposes. This is, you know, a stabbing, an incident that, you know, obviously allegedly there are charges going on and there was a counter-terror raid, you know, this week linked to this incident. This is part of allegedly a live, you know, counter-terror incident. You know, this person, maybe people were allegedly inspired by, you know, religious extremism. It is a bit of a different kettle of fish. And this is part of the argument that hasn't really got a whole lot of play, is that there are, you know, classification standards and that sort of thing about what sort of content people should be allowed to watch. If this was a video of, you know, the prime minister picking his nose or, you know, something like that, and the government's like, take that video down Twitter, like that would be one thing. But this is something that, you know, authorities, experts, you know, have said is something that shouldn't be on the internet. Not just, oh, we would like it not to be there because it's embarrassing. It's, you know, something that has been deemed to be graphic, horrific, violent content.
Because the concern here is
allegedly
that, the concern here is that it could radicalise other people and you know, it could encourage copycat sort of attacks to happen. Or
I think that's part. Those are all factors. I think, yeah, definitely.
Look, I think it's important to note that this injunction currently only captures 65 specific posts, and new uploads won't be blocked or banned under the current order. So it's not as simple as saying we're blocking, you know, the entire world from seeing what went down. We're saying these specific videos. I do think it's concerning if other countries started to do this. I don't think this case would set the precedent for that, but I understand it is a really worrying argument. I think, though, the sort of bigger issue than just this one video, because there are millions of similar videos, there's millions of ways people can be radicalized online, there's so much material out there. I think the bigger discussion should be not just on censoring this one video and this one attack. It should be about, you know, what social media giants are doing to regulate the material seen online, and what classifications are there, and is it enough? And how are they moderating that online content to sort of stop people from being radicalized or being exposed to this sort of rhetoric or videos where they might, you know, be sympathetic towards them?
How do you think the government's going, though, in winning this argument in terms of to the Australian people? Because we've heard this week from ASIO's Director General Mike Burgess and the AFP Commissioner. Now, Rhys Kershaw, the AFP Commissioner, he's arguing that there's no absolute right to privacy when it comes to social media and encrypted messaging services. Are those comments concerning to you at all, Amber? Because I think it would definitely be raising the ire of many Australians around the country. I'm not sure if it's going to get everybody on side.
I do find it concerning. Obviously, it's a problem that Meta and X have been accused of hindering police investigations. Obviously, the police do very, very amazing things when it comes to taking down, you know, child sex abuse rings, and they do that through infiltrating these networks and through accessing things that the public, you know, can't access. But I think it is concerning simply because we have had so many allegations or cases where the government and regulators haven't handled our data correctly. You know, a huge example is police in Queensland accessing domestic violence victims' new addresses and phone numbers and things like that. And then it just gets bigger and bigger from, you know, Medicare data and so on and so forth. So I think the public has sort of lost faith that if the government had access to these sorts of things and if we didn't have this right to privacy, what protections are in place? It's a little bit, you know, they need to prove themselves before they can ask us or other social media giants for their trust in how they handle that.
In 2018, Facebook established an oversight board which claims to make independent decisions about content on Facebook and Instagram. Do we know if that's been an effective way to tackle this question of free speech versus, you know, the need for content moderation? Amber?
I think when it comes to voluntary codes, you know, it's always a concern. I think sort of whilst companies say they're independent and they're voluntary, staffing is a massive concern. I don't know what's happened with Facebook and Instagram. I don't know what the outcome of that is. But there has been, at Meta, at X, an absolute culling of moderators, of the teams that are in charge of this. So it's really hard to say what the impact is. I'm not completely aware of what that's done. But I do think just asking companies to do it themselves is always going to be a real problem.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I mean, you know, part of what the government's next tranche of legislation in this area is talking about, whether, you know, some of these voluntary codes should be made mandatory, whether there should be, you know, government oversight or the eSafety Commissioner oversight on some of these codes, make them more enforceable, more penalties, that sort of thing. On the Facebook oversight board, that did get a lot of play when it first came out, but I think it only really deals with a relatively small number of cases each year. I mean, like, maybe that's very understandable when you think about, you know, how many billions of people have Facebook accounts. Like, obviously they can't moderate every single, you know, discussion or every single complaint or report on Facebook. But I think that is part of the discussion that we're having here about, you know, some, for a long time, a lot of these codes, and, you know, not just for the social media companies, like we're talking about, you know, there's all these reviews into, like, the supermarkets and this sort of thing. I mean, I think there is a broader reckoning in society about, you know, how much power and leeway we give to big companies of whatever industry, and whether some of those big companies have prioritized, you know, profit or growth or expansion or shareholders or, you know, returns or whatever metric you want to use, prioritize that over, you know, the safety or the enjoyment or the, you know, lives of their customers, users, what have you. So I think there is a broader discussion, and this, you know, obviously the tech companies are one very big part of it, about, you know, the power that big companies have in our society at the moment, and whether they've been sort of left to their own devices for too long, and whether the power that they have amassed is maybe too much, too powerful to let them run themselves.
So it's definitely a watch this space situation.
I think so. I mean, the government's, like, outlined a broad range of things that they might plan to look at over coming weeks and months. So I think we might see a number of big changes on a number of different levels around the tech industry specifically in the not too distant future.
Just changing tack a little bit here. In the last fortnight, you know, there's been two extremely violent events that have happened across Sydney. What responsibility do you think we really have as a media when it comes to reporting on these issues in a way that doesn't create more harm on top of what's already happened?
If I can jump in again, I find this really interesting because of the way sort of graphic content is treated in different countries. I spent several years living in Spain, and there's, you know, they will show, you know, absolutely gruesome images on the front page of the paper with no blurring. So it really comes down a little bit, I suppose, to public appetite and what people are comfortable seeing. I think especially, you know, the media's lost so much trust in its audiences, and we frequently see people disengage from the news because they struggle with what's being presented, how it's being presented, and the sort of constant bad news coming out. And I think if someone isn't ready to see graphic images like that, if they're just scrolling their feeds and they're confronted with it, I don't think that that's fair on them. I don't think they sort of had consent to be shocked by graphic imagery. So I think when the media not only displays those images but reports on it, we do have to be very careful in using the correct terminology, you know, making sure we're not further inciting violence or making people aware of certain channels where they could access that material. It is really a fine line between reporting and promoting.
Josh?
Yeah, I think, you know, with a few obvious notable examples in the last couple of weeks around, you know, the person that was wrongly identified as the stabber in Bondi, I think mostly the coverage of these particular incidents has been, I think, on the whole, relatively responsible and could have been a lot more explosive or a lot more sort of incendiary in a worse circumstance. I've been really interested in like how much coverage, you know, some of these particular online sort of influencer news personality sort of fake news people have gotten in the last couple of weeks. There's been a few that have been covered sort of quite extensively in the mainstream media and given a bit of a platform. I think there is always that that sort of argument between, you know, giving something the appropriate scrutiny and light versus amplifying something unnecessarily. I think in these situations, you know, obviously there is so much chaos and so much confusion in the initial periods when these sort of incidents are happening. It is very hard to report on these things sometimes. I think on the whole, things were relatively responsible. I think most of the mainstream outlets did a pretty good job of not, you know, blowing this up, you know, out of proportion of what it was, you know, these incidents out of proportion for what they were. It will be interesting, I think, more ongoing. I think there's a broader conversation to be had around, you know, not just these incidents, but what they say sort of more broadly around, you know, social cohesion and sort of unity and that sort of thing in society. I think that is a tricky discussion for the media to have. And I'll be interested to see how that sort of plays out over coming weeks. These stories aren't going away. Both these awful stabbing incidents, I think, will have quite a long tail, I guess, in the stories to tell, and probably a lot more to come. So I'll be interested to see how they reported ongoing, I guess.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank our guests on Fourth Estate this week, Josh Butler.
Yeah, thanks.
And Amber Schultz.
Thanks so much, Tina.
And thank you for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. A big thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, of course, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate. I'm Tina Quinn. Thanks for listening. Stay well, stay safe, and we'll catch you next week on Fourth Estate.